It's an understatement to say that it's a great pleasure to have Pierre Boulez back in Chicago with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra conducting 2 weeks of concerts, music of Stravinsky and others, and one Music Now program, and I'm sure he's doing other activities, and as soon as he's done with all of that, he picks up the orchestra, puts it in his pocket, and flies to New York and gives two more concerts of the same two programs at Carnegie Hall. And he does this in the midst of a whirlwind of activity for anybody, but particularly for somebody who is also busy composing. So I know that just to even have a few minutes with the maestro is a special opportunity. So welcome back to Chicago.
Thank you.
You're doing a lot of Stravinsky on these programs, and in some ways, I guess the marquee item is the full Pulcinella, including the songs, and wondering if you might say something about how you came to this project, either before or this time.
Well, I have conducted the full version of Pulcinella a couple of times already. I like, because that's I don't like the neoclassical style of Stravinsky, I must tell it always, since I am 20, I guess. So
that hasn't changed.
That has not changed at all. For instance, if you ask me about Oedipus Rex or Apollon Musagète, that's really things, works that I don't really appreciate very much.
They're but sterile or?
They are more or less sterile. So when you compare to the first period of Stravinsky, that's a kind of, you know, classical effort to do something which goes for centuries. And finally, that's the other ones which goes for centuries and not these ones. Well, that's my opinion, at least.
Yes.
And but I find with Pulcinella, on the contrary, it takes a kind of music which had no special value, and toys with it, and that kind of stylistic game, and that's really very witty sometimes, and especially you don't return to the original music, because this music is sufficient by itself,
right.
And the parody of style is very big success. I think a little bit like Berio did with Sinfonia, for instance, when he took the Scherzo of Mahler and then added or changed the text to add some bits by himself. And then I find that's very interesting. I could not do that myself, you know, I am not in this direction, but I appreciate when it is well done, there is a touch of humor with it. So, I mean, humor in music is not really the easiest thing to be done. And Stravinsky is one of the rare musicians who get to do humoristic things without help of a text, for instance, or an explanation.
What difference does the work make when the songs are included?
Well, it is complete, really. You know, you have numbers. Of course, you know, when you have the instrumental version, then that's shorter because you have not only cut the songs, but you have cut also some places in the ballet, which I don't know why exactly. He did find that too long. He made a version which is just 20 minutes and the other version is 40 minutes. You never know why exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can, like for instance, the concert version of Firebird, you don't understand why he cut short some places which are very interesting. Therefore, I don't try to understand.
But you do, for the same reason that you do the complete Firebird, it makes sense to do this complete.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a piece of music.
Absolutely, because it has a succession of moments which are very logical, very well organized, and it's sufficient for an explanation for me.
How should an instrumentalist and how should a singer in this piece be thinking, looking just at the notes on the page, or thinking about the encounter between Stravinsky and quote-unquote Pergolesi?
Well, I think also nobody has read Pergolesi or has heard Pergolesi, me the first, as a matter of fact, you know. I don't think that's really music which is terribly important in the 18th century. But you look at that like many other music of the time. I don't try to reach a kind of authenticity or parody of authenticity. I take the text as it is, and I'm also myself toying with it, And I like, for instance, when Stravinsky does wrong harmonies, for instance, or harmonies which are not quite the right ones, mm-hmm. without being totally wrong, or when he puts the dynamic accents, or when he changes the rhythms and make uneven rhythms instead of the very classical even rhythms, and so on and so forth. That's why I enjoy that, and I hope that the audience understands all the inside jokes also mm-hmm. sometimes. Mm-hmm.
But I guess also for a player, now that so many players do have experience with music from earlier centuries, should they be thinking...
Well, they don't play Pulcinella, that's the only
right,
thing.
Right,
so they play only the authentic music or the so-called authentic music, and they don't care very much for the parody.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So a modern orchestra player is going to understand this is coming through Stravinsky.
Well,
so,
yes, he is maybe better related to the music by Stravinsky, even if Stravinsky takes some starting point from Pergolesi. But I mean, a man who plays contemporary music is more able to do that than somebody who is totally, let's say, involved with music of the 18th century.
Right. In the first week's concerts, you had two works of Stravinsky at the beginning and two of Varese at the end, and we'll come back to the middle part, speaking of works that perhaps successfully contain humor, the work by Elliot Carter. I had an idea listening to that program, and I don't know if it has any validity, but I'll present it to you. I thought that by presenting the Symphony in Three Movements and the Four Studies for Orchestra, and then the Ionisation and the Amerique, there was a chance for people perhaps to think that with Stravinsky, we think we know his influence today. But we don't always recognize the achievement of some of the individual pieces, the success of putting them together, sculpting them, whatever. With Varese, we all think we know the achievement, what he did at his time, but we forget how his influence was so deep and is still so powerful, I would say. I don't know if that... is a valid observation.
No, I don't know if Varese had an influence, really. Yes, he was influential on somebody like Xenakis, mm-hmm. or other people in France, especially, not at all in Germany.
Mm-hmm. But certainly in this country he was very influential.
Yes.
I think he liberated people when they saw these things they could do with pure rhythm and with massing. Yeah.
Certainly, but it took time. I remember the first visit I did to Varese was in 1952. I was in New York in 1952. And then he was still quite isolated.
Right.
And not at all accepted by the musical world generally. His big time was the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when the neoclassical wave became so important, especially with Aaron Copland and other composers, but Copland was the figure mm-hmm. Of neoclassicism, then, and populism also. Varese disappeared completely.
Yeah. Some of that was his personality too, though, wasn't it? Didn't he sort of push back at this idea of being mainstream in any way?
Well, no, I think he refused that, mm-hmm. Totally. But, I mean, he was toward the future. He looked very much toward the future, but he wanted also electronic music.
Right.
He began to have contact with theremin. Mm-hmm. He asked for subsidies to work in the Bell telephone company and so on, and mm-hmm. nothing happened practically.
Right, right.
So he was quite discouraged and did not compose for quite a long time.
Yes.
And he began to compose after the 50s,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. when then he had, like people like me, for instance, mm-hmm. Recognized him. I performed him in Paris in the series of concerts I was organizing. And so he was recognized, although, when Désert was performed for the first time, it was, a riot, absolutely, because the program was totally absurd.
Yeah.
There was a work of Mozart, I don't remember what work of Mozart before, and there was Désert by Varese with all the electronics, and then at the end there was a Tchaikovsky number 5 or something like that.
That's really
which was grotesque.
Bizarre. Grotesque.
Totally grotesque.
Yeah.
And the program
not fair
was,
to any of the composers or the audience.
Yes, and I suppose, as it was the beginning of the revival of Baroque music and especially Italian music, Vivaldi and so on, mm-hmm. And some people saw Varese on the program. They thought it was maybe a kind of Vivaldi they have not heard of. It was absurd as a combination. And the audience was totally, you know, that was, it was not a scandal like The Rite of Spring. It was a scandal because the program was totally wrong. Simply that.
What do you recall from your meetings with Varese?
That he was in the same time, you know, he showed around at some in his studio the kind of sketches he has done. And
this was in Greenwich Village, not far from where Elliot Carter is.
Yes. That was not very far from Washington Square. That was in the Italian district of downtown. And but he was rather secretive. And after his death, I met quite regularly his wife, I'd say his widow. And she told me that he had a great fits of depression. Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, he was supposed to be, you know, a great strength and a model for fighting everything and everybody. But on the contrary, he had these fits of temper and his moments of fight. But most of the time, after, you know, he saw this kind of neoclassical wave and being on the side totally and forgotten almost, then as I mean, he had fits of depression and he had difficulties to survive, simply that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean.
Somebody who, if he's had fits of depression, has kept them very much to himself and who has found a way to survive is, of course, Elliot Carter, now 100 years old, and composing frequently and with great success.
Yes, until now. Also, I mean, you know, I have heard the concert. We did a concert, we participated to a concert for his centenary in London. And Pierre-Laurent Aymard played the new pieces for piano, which were absolutely lively and very vital. And astonishing of somebody who is 100 to have this kind of vitality. Yes, yeah. I mean, I wish myself, although I am not to complain for the time being, but I wish myself that I would be in a couple of years will be as lively as that.
So. Yeah. You chose, though, to do here in Chicago one of his quite ancient works from his 90s, just from 6 years ago, I think, Réflexion.
Yes, that was...
Well, we are also going to come to the work, earlier work.
Yes, that's
we'll come to that in a moment.
No, yeah. I did. I do this week, as I mean, still two performances to come. I do the Reflections, and he wrote that for me. You know, for but I mean, you can multiply the number of strings to have a better balance. Mm-hmm. And then that's what I mean, we do with more strings than I did with the first performance.
Because and originally it was just written for the personnel of the ensemble.
Of the ensemble contemporain, yes. And we had, generally, we had the woodwind and the brass by two. Mm. And then we have three violins, two violas, two celli, and one bass. But then at some point we took six violins and down to two basses. Yeah. So the volume is bigger and much better.
I think once you have a contrabass clarinet, you better have something to balance it out, right?
Yes. Well, he used it very carefully. That was, you know, we had two experiences with contrabass clarinet. We had with Matthias Pinscher, we had a piece with, there was a big contrabass clarinet solo, which was horribly difficult.
This was in the Osiris, the recent piece?
That was in the series before, the last season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was really a difficult piece to perform. But we performed it. But this solo for contrabass clarinet is much nicer, so to speak, and easier to perform. As a matter of fact, you know, that general, the toughest pieces of Elliott are between the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Mm-hmm. And then after, not he went milder, but I mean, I think with the number of performances he had, he noticed that, you know, things which theoretically are possible or, you know, you can write them, but they come to the performance very rarely because if you have to work on half an hour on one bar, generally, you don't have the time to do that, simply that. So practically, you have a kind of approximation of the things. And I think, you know, he does not write approximation, but I mean, his style has used more simple elements, which are easier to get and to really to get properly with accuracy.
And you're saying perhaps that that's been aided in a way by his... being frequently performed in
yes,
recent years.
Certainly, yeah. He has made the experience, yes. I am sure. And certainly, also, I mean, the works now are easier to perform. Mm-hmm. If I compare, for instance, Reflections and the piece we perform for Music Now,
yes.
The mirror on which to dwell, I did not give the first performance. It was the group in New York, mm-hmm. Speculum Musicae, who gave the first performance. But I gave the first performance in England mm-hmm. with the BBC, and I gave immediately also the performance in Paris with my ensemble. And then, as I mean, of course, these pieces are conceived for a chamber group, very mm-hmm. small chamber group, six people. So you can make much more with six people than you do with 110, certainly, yes. because you have more time.
Yes.
And you have more responsibility also, directly communication. And therefore, also, I mean, I see that when I was rehearsing The Mirror on Which You Dwell, I saw how much more complex it was from the rhythmical point of view, for instance, from the balance point of view, from the texture point of view. Mm-hmm. And so it asked for more work, simply mm-hmm. that.
Interesting that you were working on these two pieces, the one from recent times and
yes.
the one from
the 70s,
early in his
yes.
career, from
yes.
the 70s.
Yes.
In this kind of pairing. Coming back to the second week of concerts, I would say the first composer that comes to mind when one says Pierre Boulez is not Szymanowski.
No, certainly not. Although I know Szymanowski for a very long time. There was a French violinist, Jacques Thibault, who was very mm-hmm. famous in his time. And I remember I went when I was still a student in Lyon, so not even in Paris, before my staying in Paris. That was during the war, it must have been 42 or 43. He played a piece by Szymanowski, The Myth. And I remember very precisely of one in particular, which is called La Fontaine d'Arethuse, mm-hmm. for violin and piano originally. And it was very striking to me because I had never heard this type of vocabulary before. And I had never forgotten that. Hmm. So, you know, I did not have the opportunity to put it on the program because I thought I had more urgent things to do then. But now that I perform the Viennese School quite a lot and Stravinsky and Bartok and Varese, you know, I am interested to also for myself to discover also in depth. When you perform, you have to look at the scores very closely. And then, as I mean, I was ready for doing... So this violin concerto I have done already, and I've done also the second one. So I did them both, and they both are interesting, but the first one is, for me, also more interesting than the second one.
Therefore, did you also do them with Frank-Peter Zimmermann before? Or?
No, I did it before with Tetzlaff
okay.
a couple of times with the LSO in London.
Right.
And on a tour, we did a tour with it.
But
and therefore that interests me to do it with another violinist
sure.
now. And with another orchestra also.
But interesting, too, that each of these are younger German violinists who also have a strong connection with... the classical and modern repertoire, much more so than we would also immediately associate them with Szymanowski. So
yes.
they bring a great intellect as well, I would think, to their performing.
Well, I think, I mean, you are discovering, so we are discovering all Szymanowski. I think the first one, I must say, I was surprised, because when I read that he has done a recording already 4 or 5 years ago, it was Rattle.
Mm-hmm.
Rattle has recorded the two violin concertos, and I am not sure that he even has recorded the symphony number 3.
Mm-hmm.
And myself, I will do with Vienna, again, the first violin concerto, this with Tetzlaff this time in June. And next June, or in next season, I will do the symphony number 3, because that's also an interesting piece.
So you're in your Szymanowski period.
Not exclusive. No, not exclusive. But I mean... That's interesting. And in Paris, in the Paris Opera, I think it will be the last production of Gérard Mortier before he leaves Paris. Mm-hmm. He's putting on the stage the King Roger.
King Roger,
yes.
Yeah.
Because I never seen that.
Yeah, was just done somewhere else recently, and I remember somebody saying it was the first performance in however many decades when that was done. I'm sorry, I'm right now forgetting where that
in Paris, that's
was
the first ever.
Yeah, right.
Certainly.
But this was either in Britain or in the US. But you're not conducting that. You're just
No. I will go simply to the performance.
But it's interesting too, because there are people who say, "Oh, this conductor or that composer has no interest in anything that he isn't already interested in." But because perhaps of that memory of that one piece, when
yes.
the time arrived, you're saying, well, let me investigate
yes.
this a little bit
yes.
more.
I am curious because I don't want simply to do and redo and redo and redo always the same pieces.
Right. Right.
Because you have not a fresh approach anymore.
Yes.
I mean.
Yes.
And, the program of this week I like very much because it shows really three pieces which have absolutely no connection, but which were written in a span of time very, very limited, maybe
right.
5 years, something like that. The Sinfonietta of Janáček, the violin concerto of Szymanowski, and then, as I mean, the Pulcinella Stravinsky. And that you cannot think that they were by three people who are living, as I mean,
right.
Exactly at the same age.
Well, they were, but just on different planets.
Although Stravinsky and Szymanowski were the same age,
yeah.
practically. They
were yeah.
both born in 82.
Mm-hmm.
And that's difficult to imagine that Janáček was older than Debussy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
all the, for me, the important works are written all after the death of Debussy, practically.
Mm-hmm.
So from 1916, 18, so let's
yes.
say, to the end of his life.
Yes.
So sometimes to compare the kind of facts like that
mm-hmm.
is very instructive. You cannot have, the story is not one branch. The history has many branches,
mm-hmm.
even in the same time.
And to be able to see those branches together, but in a way that will probably fit better than Mozart, Varese, and the Fifth of Tchaikovsky.
Oh, that's what I mean. Yeah, no, of course not. I mean.
These were different trees, just different branches.
You would do Webern and Karl Orff one after another.
Oh, please,
I mean, that's.
But it's interesting, too, when you mention about the Janáček and Debussy and the unexpected timeline, you
mm-hmm.
might say. Driving over to our interview today, I was listening to our station, and we have a gentleman, Andy Karzis, who has a great collection of old vocal recordings. And he was playing a recording of Lili Lehmann, not Lotte Lehmann, Lili
yes.
Lehmann. She was born in 1848, and she made her recordings. You know, she was
70
she was,
or something like that.
She
no?
made her. She was in her 60s. So these are recordings made at the
turn of the century.
These
yeah.
were some of the early, but you hear the power, and you can see why this woman was, the first Vogelinde and was Brunhilde and
yeah,
all of these
yeah,
things.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
it also took you back to Wagner's own time because she was singing for Wagner.
Yes.
You know, so I mean, it's a way that sometimes things, if they just go long enough and fall into the technology, we can hear them.
Well, you can speculate, of course, if Mozart would have lived as old as. Let's say Wagner, for instance, if only that. That's
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
He would have added 35 years to his life, practically. And he would have been, he would have heard all the main works of Beethoven.
Yeah.
And that's difficult to imagine,
yes,
this type of
yes,
thing.
Yes.
And finally, you cannot not make any comparison because it goes to absurdity.
Right. I forget which philosopher, I think it was a British one, but he had an article a few years ago in which he said that these games don't go anywhere, because his explanation was, if Mozart had lived any longer than he did, well, he just would have stopped writing music and would have done something else, that actually we do have Mozart as he lived, because he was done. You know?
Yes.
So it's another way to think about it.
That's a view of things. You die when you are finished.
You have two other contemporary composers on your Music Now program, and maybe you could say something about them.
Yes, they're both very, very interesting. One is older, and is kind of German established. He's living in Berlin right now. And it's very interesting because that's a complex, he writes a complex music. Although that's very seductive, the kind of sound he gets from the instruments he uses is very, very interesting, very lively.
This is Kyburz.
That's Kyburz.
Kyburz.
Sorry, yes, I mean to pronounce it. You pronounce Kyburz here, but I mean...
I want to pronounce it the way you think we should pronounce it.
So that's not me. That's simply...
It's him?
The German Kyburz, yeah. And for me, he is one of the composers the most interesting, which...
You did a work with the full orchestra about 15 years ago, yes. 10, 15 years ago.
Not this month.
Not that long ago?
That was in... when was 9/11?
2001.
I did it in 2002 or 2003, yeah. I don't remember now. Mm-hmm. But that means it was after that.
Yeah.
And I did it in Cleveland. I did it here also.
Yes, and on tour, I think.
And on tour, yes. And it was a very interesting work. Mm-hmm. And I did it also with the orchestra of the Academy in Lucerne. Mm-hmm. And the young people did it extremely well, I must say. But we have more time to rehearse.
Of course,
than,
yeah.
I mean,
And
Mantovani is a young French, although the name does not tell it. That's, I mean, he's from Italian parents, but I mean, all grown up in France. That's, I mean, his education is really French, and his musical education also is French. And he's very gifted, very spontaneous. And you can see, also, I mean, there is the gesture is there. The thinking is less complex than the one of Kyburz, for instance. But I mean, there is more gesture, more direct gesture, and very convincing to me. And he has also a great feeling for the sound produced. The sound conducts him much more than the kind of abstract reflection, so let's say. That's the impression he gives to me, at least.
I'm getting a sense almost of two visual artists, one who is making a very large and very detailed etching, perhaps.
Yes.
And the other one who is doing something with
splash.
Some very visible splashes
yes,
and
exactly.
strokes, but
yes.
it doesn't mean one is better or worse.
No, they are both ways of expressing.
I don't
put that on the value. I put that simply on the type of gesture. One is more reflective, the other one is more outgoing. I mean, that's the difference between introvert and an extrovert. I mean, simply that.
Speaking of art, you recently had what must have been an interesting experience. I hope it was an interesting experience. It certainly got a lot of attention. You curated a show at the Louvre.
Yes, at the Louvre, yes. It was very interesting. They have a guest every year. And there were two guests before me. One was a lawyer. Who has abolished the death penalty in France.
Aha, okay.
And Badinter, his name, Robert Badinter. And he was asked, you know, to make an exhibition and to organize a symposium about freedom, death, and penalty generally. And, you know, you have quite a lot of punishment. Yeah. You have a lot of painting which are in this direction.
Yes.
I mean, and it was organized around this theme. And the second guest was Toni Morrison. And, of course, it was about racial issues, difference of color, difference of culture, difference and so on. And it was also very successful. And they asked me, because I know the director of the museum, who is very interested in music and who comes regularly to concerts, and not only to conservative concerts, let's say, but he goes to modern concerts.
Right.
He likes really to be involved with that. We spoke about what for theme, and when I was in the Collège de France, when I was giving these lessons there, now more than 15 years ago, the last lesson I gave was about is a work a fragment of something bigger, even disorganized, or is the work is totally closed on itself. And that was very interesting to see, you know, how you can be confused with sketch and especially in painting, a sketch and finished work.
Yes, yes.
And the more you go, the less you are sure it is finished or it is just kind of... in progress.
Right.
Thing.
Right.
And then there was a small exhibition, but very sharp. And they showed to me also, I mean, the reserve they have in the Louvre, sketches, drawings, etchings, and so on and so forth. And then also, I mean, we chose, we did not go back to the 16th century, although they have, you know, many resources. But we did not go back to the 19th century when it really began to be not sure if you are a sketch or mm-hmm. a definite, mm-hmm. or you accept it as a definite work.
Right.
For instance, you know, in the output of Cézanne, for instance,
yes.
he made quite a lot of watercolors.
Right.
But he did not take them himself
mm-hmm.
seriously enough to say, you know, my watercolors are finished works.
Right.
He
right.
kept them all.
Right. I'm thinking, too, some of the studies of Degas. You see them and you would like to have them in your home.
Yes.
But he thought it was just the underscoring.
Yes, yeah. And that's a study. We had also some Degas mm-hmm. sketches or drawings. And that was very interesting to show also how, for instance, in music, the continuity of a work comes maybe at the end. So mm-hmm. we found the original of Stravinsky's sketches for Rite of Spring. And, you know, that's in a total disorder sometimes. Mm-hmm. And how it organized at the end, then you see how the work takes, you know, the state status of a work, really.
Yes.
That was, for me, very interesting. We had a symposium even on the future Philharmonie of Paris, which is in project, but a project which will be done. And that's interesting to see, you know, the difference or the difference of opinion or, between the architect Jean Nouvel, who mm-hmm. is, you know, a Pritzker Prize here,
yes.
and the musician, because we discussed about the hall, about the acoustics, about how mobile a hall must be, and so on and so forth. That was very interesting, and so we had concerts also, we had concerts in the museum, even. Mm-hmm. It was really a very extraordinary concert, a wandering concert.
Mm-hmm.
And in front of some paintings, we have the musician visiting the museum long before and say, do you want in this frame or in this frame? And so, and so that was very interesting to see. You know,
it must have been. It yes. must have been. You're filling me with tremendous regret.
And the next guest after me will be Umberto Eco, which is about collection.
Yes. It's going to be about collection.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
But it's quite a collection, the four of you.
Yes.
So far.
Oh, no. Sorry, but I mean it will be about because yeah. the museum is right. accumulation.
Yes.
Of
and this is what he deals with in his writing
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly.
Accumulation of ideas
yes.
or of books even.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
How interesting. So the Philharmonie will be built in Paris.
Yes, it has begun really.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it is not for tomorrow morning, but it will take approximately two years or three years.
And this is out at the Cité.
That's at the Cité de la Musique,
yeah.
yes,
mm-hmm.
further there. The problem is more how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to think about the parkings, parking lots, about how to go there, how to enlarge the streets, and so on and so forth.
And
so
who is doing the acoustics?
The acoustics, that's the man who worked for Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember
Toyota.
His name now.
Yeah.
Yes, at Toyota, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, I don't personally, but I mean the man in charge, whom I know very well, has required three acousticians.
Mm-hmm.
He does not want to be prisoner of one acoustician.
Yes, yes.
And I think he's right.
Well, this is always the battle, and it's also what... You can get any architect you want, but if in the end the sound is not right,
yes,
what's
no,
the point?
Exactly. So, yeah. And you know, they have sometimes preconceived ideas about acoustical conditions, and therefore that's better to discuss about it before mm-hmm. it comes a fact or something.
But this, of course, has the potential really to transform musical life in
Paris.
In Paris,
yes,
to have a real symphonic concert hall,
a real good one. Also, I hope so. But I mean, with all the facilities around, with the museum, with a data bank, you know, quite a lot of things you can consult, internet, and so on and so forth.
Yes,
I mean,
and you have the other existing smaller hall that's
yes,
such a success
yes,
already.
Yeah.
Well, Maestro Boulez, we know that you have a busy schedule and you have another concert evening while we're speaking, and then I'm sure rehearsals tomorrow, and then music now on Monday, and then another concert on Tuesday. I shouldn't remind you of all of this, but thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Pleasure for me.
If you're listening to our initial broadcast of this conversation with Pierre Boulez on Monday night, the 2nd of March, 2009, maybe you're just home from the CSO Music Now concert. In any event, you have one more opportunity tomorrow night Tuesday at 7:30 to hear the first program of Stravinsky and Varèse. And we opened our program this evening with the Ionisation from 1929 to 1931, a work for 13 percussionists played so wonderfully at Orchestra Hall this week by the CSO Percussion Section. And you heard it with a slightly different roster of percussionists recorded by Pierre Boulez and the CSO in December of 1995 and released in 2001. Boulez conducts Varèse. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, you'll be able to hear Program 2, the Sinfonietta of Janáček, the first violin concerto of Szymanowski with Frank-Peter Zimmermann as soloist, and the complete Pulcinella ballet with the songs. And so we thought it would be interesting, and it's going to be a bit arbitrary, but hey, it's Cubist music. We're going to play for you, without interruption, the 9 songs derived from Pergolesi and others by Stravinsky and sprinkled throughout the complete ballet score. So it's not the suite that you usually hear that you'll be hearing Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then again Monday and Tuesday if you're in New York. It is going to be the full score, and we're now going to hear the songs, and our singers will be Diana Montague, mezzo, Robin Leggett, known here, tenor, and Mark Beasley, bass, Robert Kraft conducting the Philharmonia, no date given, but recorded at Abbey Road and released in 1999.
Se mai potessi credere che ancora lontan tu sei, vedere. Restate qua, restate qua. Che se tu dite appresso, se dite dite appresso, io t'esso morirò. C'esso morirò. Morirò, morirò, morirò. Yeah.
not so bloody, we hope, chunks, as we said, and we hope very much that the current recording project with Maestro Boulez and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra of the Stravinsky works that he's doing here in Chicago will indeed culminate in a new recording on the CSO Resound label. The songs, including a couple of trios from the complete ballet score Pulcinella of Igor Stravinsky, written in 1920, recorded there by Robert Kraft with Diana Montague, Robin Leggett, Mark Beasley, and the London Philharmonia, released in 1999. Drop us a note. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. That's Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. While we're talking computerese, visit us online at WFMT.com/critical thinking, one word, where you can experience the Critical Thinking podcast. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation and Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm, as well as Dick and Susan Kiphart and other friends of this program. We want to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great, and Grammy Award winner Chris Willis for recording our interview on Saturday at Orchestra Hall with Pierre Boulez. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.
Yes, no, exactly.